I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our Urbanite conversations, another of our monthly conversations that will turn to a Q&A on the pages, but be a much more longer and interesting interview as you tune in here or download us from the web. And we're joined today by Irene Hoffman, who since 2006 has been the executive director of Baltimore's Contemporary Museum. Irene, a pleasure to meet you. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
So the Contemporary has been around for 10 years.
20 years.
20 years.
Yes.
Did I say 10? I meant 20. But you've been at a home. You've had a home for 10 years.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. The museum is celebrating its 20th anniversary.
This year.
This past December was the official sort of founding month. And yes, the first 10 years or so, the museum was nomadic. It was known as the Museum Without Walls.
Right.
And was organizing projects in other organizations, in other institutions, in vacant buildings, outside, in public space, sort of moving around the city, sort of following whatever the idea of the exhibition was. That's where that led the curators to find a home for that show, for that temporary moment. And then after 10 years of that sort of nomadic programming, which had incredible energy and saw some of the contemporary's sort of most visible collaborations with other organizations like the Walters, like the Peabody, and others, certainly, that then the museum found a home, looked for some bricks and mortar to be able to, I think the idea was really to be able to have year-long programming, which wasn't possible in the previous scenario, to build a larger audience, to build the base, and to give the institution a few roots.
So how does that change things, do you think? I mean, you've done a lot of work over the years as a curator around the country and around the world. How does that change an institution to go from being kind of a freewheeling, moving through communities and then almost like a guerrilla art to being established in a building in the middle of Mount Vernon?
I think it was very challenging in the first years. The identity of the institution shifted from one of being out in the community and out in collaborating with other institutions, and right away with a gallery, with a white box to fill, with bricks and mortar to pay for, the shift had to change. And I think for a number of years, as it moved into the new its new space, it took a while to find sort of what its new identity was going to be. And it's understandable. It's very understandable. And I think since I arrived, I keep trying to break out of those bricks and mortar, break out of the gallery space, or at least when we are confined with an exhibition within the four walls of the museum, to alter it as much as possible beyond a usual experience of an art museum.
So you've been in this line of work as a curator for the kinds of exhibits that would be in the Contemporary for a while now.
Correct.
This has been your life's work.
It has. It has.
So I think just for people to get a sense of in the very beginning here is to talk a bit about how this differs from what people might see in an art gallery or what people might see at the Walters or at the BMA or any other place. I mean, this is
sure.
Because much of the stuff that you do is from what I've seen at the museum and at other exhibits and just reading on the web today and yesterday over the weekend is, I mean, it's very cutting edge. Doing stuff that's not seen,
right.
That, you know, where we hang Matisse. So,
right. Well, first I would say that as personally, as a curator, I have been and am a slightly different curator with every institution that I've been. For example, earlier in my career, I was at Cranbrook Art Museum, wonderful museum outside of Detroit, and it has a collection. And that collection looks at design at mid-century in America. Charles and Ray Eames, Harry Bertoia, the buildings were built by Aliel Saarinen, the furniture by Eero Saarinen. It was a collection and an art school and a campus that I really took into consideration as I curated exhibitions. So I was curating exhibitions there within that context of that collection and that audience. Next, moving to a place like Southern California, to Orange County, where there again was a collection that I was part of helping to build, looking for new work to bring into that collection, really thinking about the legacy there of California art. That was really the focus. And so as I came to Baltimore, I thought a lot about the other museums in town, where the contemporary fits in, what makes it distinctive, why it started to begin with. And this museum started to begin with out of a very similar kind of spark that happened in other cities around the country in the around the 1980s, when art was getting very large scale, site specific, political. It was starting to look perhaps at moments more like activism than art. The art object was starting to disappear. Technology was coming in, the video projector, the emergence of all of this new work, new forms were not necessarily finding a venue yet in the established, more encyclopedic museums, even though they may have a modern or contemporary department, collection, and curator. There still was suddenly all of this work that didn't have a place to be shown. It was largely untested. It was, in many cases, very radical, radical ideas, radical forms. And in Baltimore, as in Chicago, as in Los Angeles and other cities, an alternative space was formed. And so that is the spirit out of which the contemporary was formed, a companion, a place, a companion to the existing museums, a companion to the Walters, to the Baltimore Museum of Art. Maryland Art Place was already in existence, but it was focusing on Maryland artists. The contemporary came on the scene to show work that none of those venues were able to show, maybe not ready to show, or maybe it was outside even their mission to show. And so that's where we remain. We remain at that point of innovation, of exploration, an artist trying something new. Not all of the artists that we show are just emerging. Many of them are much later in their career, but coming to the Contemporary Museum offers them an opportunity to take risks, to try something new, maybe to fail, but it's that energy of an artist coming here, and we almost always invite an artist to make a new work. This is where...
For the Contemporary.
For the Contemporary, for Baltimore, we ask them if it's appropriate, we ask them to respond to the city. So a lot of the work that you see at the museum is an artist from anywhere, could be anywhere in the world, but they've come here and we've asked them to make a new work. And many times it's about Baltimore, it involves community members from Baltimore, or in some way has some kind of connection to the city. So in a number of ways, it becomes this place where really new things happen. And having that kind of giving an artist the freedom to try something doesn't always...
Didn't always
turn
work.
Out the way they planned.
Right.
But as in so many creative endeavors, failure can be that thing that launches an idea to something far more interesting than originally mapped out. And that's what we that's the structure we provide and the support and the platform that, that is the Contemporary Museum.
So how do you then see art and the artist, the contemporary artist, are doing things in a different way? In other words, you know, when many people think of art, you think of somebody who's painting a picture, or a photographer, or pardon me, a sculptor doing his or her work. But something is happening out here that is very different. We talked as you came in the room about Mel Chin and his work, and he's out of Houston, but lives in North Carolina, and is doing this incredible Fundrith project that he's doing, or other people who do that kind of work. And I'm interested, because I saw what you wrote in the Audacious blog for the Open Society Institute, and this idea of melding really not just local but national, internationally renowned young and not so young creative artists with community and kind of – it's very explosive. To talk, I mean, what does that both A, philosophically and practically mean for where you think – this kind of art's going in our lives?
Well, it can be some of the most enduring work. I'm delighted that you were able to meet Mel Chin, because Mel Chin, I have two examples to share with you. Mel Chin is a wonderful example of an artist who, he makes sculptures. He makes works that are in collected by collectors, by art museums and the like. But this project that he came here to talk to you about, and that is currently on view at the Contemporary Museum, is called the $100 Project, an idea of a collective activist activity for a nation that would come together to create, to draw these $100 bills and donate them symbolically, but also as a collective voice to talk about lead poisoning, specifically in New Orleans, which is where the focus is.
See, but I know you said that city, right?
City. I've been there many times.
I'm sorry, I mean to digress, but go ahead.
Yeah. But many other cities like Baltimore, like Cleveland, and others where this is a big issue. Well, here's this artist who has come up with this concept and has now set it into motion.
Mm-hmm.
For Mel, he has begun this. Many people are now working to support this. And the ultimate goal of this piece is to turn those colored, drawn dollar bills into real money that will then help this cause. And for Mel, he's delighted to now disappear. This idea that the artist has initiated this action,
right,
but that he now disappears. And it endures. It goes on. It goes on even without him.
Mm-hmm.
We had a project now 2 summers ago, maybe even 3, Fritz Haig, a project that we initiated with Fritz. He's from Los Angeles, and his project is called Edible Estates.
Right.
And this piece begins with an idea to call attention to how we use our front lawns. We fertilize them, we water them, but we don't spend time in them. They are a barrier. They are private space, but and yet public. It mm-hmm. is the public face of our home. And so his project began a couple of years before we engaged him. He started to do this project where he'd rip up people's front lawn with the family of the house.
Right.
Oh, yeah. With community members,
right,
and plant an edible garden. And that's what we did in Baltimore. We sent out a call for houses, and about 30 families all over the city sent us pictures, videos, pictures of their children. Please choose us. It was amazing. And we looked at, we visited, we met the families, and we selected one family together.
One
family, the Liberty Heights neighborhood. And about 50 volunteers showed up. We had all the plants donated. Board members, grandchildren of the family, neighbors, amazing people from Parks and People showed up, students. And a lot of people had no idea how they heard about it. They all joined us on the lawn. We helped to build this for this family. And then we all went away. And just like with Mel's project, Fritz was there to get this project started. But as the artist, then his job was done. He steps back. And now this belongs to the family. It belongs to Clarence and Rudine Ridgely. And so, again, the artist has set up a condition to talk about an issue that is really important to them and steps back. And now it endures, and you can still go visit it. It's probably just sprouting now in its third season.
Maybe we should go take a visit over
there. That's right.
So
that really is sort of one way, and perhaps an extreme examples of an artist engaging in a social, political, environmental issue, not making objects, but creating experiences and putting something into action that moves people in a way that the idea then starts to gain its own momentum.
So I do want to talk a bit in a minute about what's happening in contemporary and how we compare it to other communities around the country and how, what's going on. But let me just continue this for a minute with you. I'm interested how you feel this pushes the boundaries of art and where it takes it. I mean, what we're talking about here, as soon as you said that, a couple things. Let me just start with A. Popped in my head was, you said 50 people applied to do this thing with this exhibit. So that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
That's a lot of communities. My first thought might run through my head. So, okay, So how do you take this incredible power of pushing the envelope of what art means to engage all those 50 people, to change actually the way we think and do things in a creative way? You know, there's such, to me, a powerful potential, or a potentially powerful movement to kind of change who we are, both artistically and culturally and as human beings, by marrying these things in a much bigger way.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of what the work you do and contemporaries here and around the country are kind of touching the edge of, or maybe even more than the edge, I should say.
Right. Well, with Mel's project, I think part of what he does is there's hope. It's like, you are concerned about this as well. You're worried about lead poisoning in your city. Here's something you can do.
Right.
It's creative, and you're connecting to hundreds to thousands of other people who are doing the same creative act. So it puts all of this sort of power behind the artistic. In the case of Fritz, having all these people on the lawn with us, so people learned. People were gardening for the first time in their lives. Mm-hmm. They learned from the artist. Hey, how do you do starter plants? What do we do to protect these when the frost comes? Or from one another.
Mm-hmm.
Those people who helped us on that lawn, I know, went home and looked differently at their own lawn.
Mm-hmm.
They looked differently at the produce section when they went grocery shopping. So, and it had, because we talked about this project, it wasn't just the 50 people. It was people who drove past the house and wondered, hey, what's he doing? What's he doing next door?
Right. Exactly.
Right? All of his neighbors now know about the project. And so it has this possibility from the artist to our smaller community to people telling more and more people about something because they were brought into the process. And I think that is something that we can do quite well, and is really inviting artists not only to come to our city and make a new piece, but then inviting the Baltimore community to sometimes take part in making the work. Watch the creative process. In many ways, we invite people to be part of that. And that can be really powerful, demystifying. It becomes much more understandable and tangible when one can participate in something. And even if questions might remain about whether this is art and how this fits within the trajectory of art history, that's okay if those questions still aren't fully answered, but what we have been able to do is engage someone in what art looks like right now and start the conversation with the artist, with the visitor. And so we have those conversations all the time about how this fits in. And sometimes we can make that link much more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're a block away from the Walters. And over a century separates where the Walters collection ends and when we pick up. And yet that is also one of the things that we're trying to do, is make those connections, whether we have an artist who is doing portraits in photography or video. We want to make that connection to what you can see in portraiture throughout the history that's right across the street. So whether it's someone who is starting at the Walters and coming to see us and looking for those connections, we try to make that for them. Or maybe it's someone who really loves contemporary art and is not sure how it relates to that, to history. We want to take them a step back as well. So we're also thinking about that because we know the kinds of forms that the artwork can take today. A cell phone, it's on the internet,
It's
everywhere.
It's
a garden.
I'm looking at some of the exhibits you have now, which I'm going to come to in a minute, because it touches that very thing you're talking about. And you are next door to the Walters, and you're lucky to have there's a guy, Gary Vicon, someone who I think is Gary's on the cutting edge of classical museums in this country. I mean, he takes it to a different place that makes it almost a contemporary experience inside a classical world.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
He's brilliant at how he manipulates and changes. I mean, it challenges us. This new exhibit they're doing coming up next fall, I can't wait for. I've been talking to folks about it a lot, is this Africans in Renaissance Europe. That is just a mind-boggling thing. I've been reading
Absolutely.
About it. Oh, my God. Those are the kind of things mm-hmm. that take art and make us begin to think about our place in society and what and how it just affects our consciousness.
Right.
You know, which is what you do in a different way.
Absolutely.
So for just a minute, go back to what you just finished saying. I think we wouldn't be right today without answering this question a lot of people may be asking as they're listening to this conversation, which is, so how does tearing up a lawn and creating a vegetable garden become art? How is that art?
Fair enough. Well, I guess I'll try to answer a couple ways.
Sure.
Fritz is an architect, trained as an architect. He's an artist. He also organizes in this incredible geodesic dome that he lives in Los Angeles, yoga class and other kinds of classes. For Fritz, his creativity, his artistic practice is this hybrid of many different things. But they are all in the service of this idea or ideas around the environment. And, you know, artists have so many tools at their disposal to address their own concerns. And in this case, for Fritz, making something that was in the gallery for only an art audience to see wasn't going to cut it.
Mm-hmm.
And here, the idea needed to be in the neighborhood, on the street, on the lawn. It needed to be out where it could. He sees this as sparking a movement. And even though 50 people applied, perhaps, to ours, he was hoping, and we could only choose one,
mm-hmm.
he was hoping that those other 49 would come, learn how to do it, and take it with them. So for him, what is taken away as the art in this, and whether it is actually understood as art, is less important for him. It is more important that this idea has momentum, that it brings people together, that they create something together. And in this case, a really unusual use of plants on a lawn. You know, he's not a landscape designer. And so there's something really freeing about the kind of design that he makes on mm-hmm. each front lawn. The drawings that he creates for each of the houses he works with does certainly speak of his own, you know, unique aesthetic. But I think to answer the art question, yes, he makes works that are seen in an art museum, but this particular project, this particular idea had the most power when it started to look like something else, when it started to not look like art, when it started to look like 50 people on a lawn ripping up a garden.
So it's also about the artistic spirit
and the power
how it transforms mm-hmm. whatever we do.
Yes, absolutely.
So you talked before we started the conversation. I know you spent time in Orange County, and this is where you ran the museum there. Right?
I was the curator of contemporary art at the Orange County Museum of Art.
Right. Mm-hmm. But you have experience around the country, and you've seen things, all done exhibits throughout. So talk about where you think Baltimore is in that scheme of things. You mentioned Detroit. You've mentioned
yeah.
Chicago. And I know you've been many other places and helped establish
yeah.
exhibits. So talk about where Baltimore is in this place where you are in terms of contemporary art and the community and how we fit into this.
Well, I think for so long, the only place to live, to make it as an artist, was New York.
Right.
Right? Okay. And I would say, for certain in the last 10 years, there are many other art centers that are emerging. Los Angeles emerged probably 15 years ago as a very viable place, wonderful art schools, gallery system and the like. Chicago, similarly. But then there are now a number of other cities, Detroit being one of them. Philadelphia, another, and Baltimore, certainly, that are outside of New York. The rents are considerably cheaper. There are some wonderful art schools in each of those cities that are creating this this new talent that's coming out of school and realizing they don't have to go to New York to make it, and realizing that they are in a city where there is so much possibility. And that's what I see happening here. I see a lot of artists who are going to school here and finding sympathetic voices in the city. I see a lot of collaboration happening here and collectives forming. Mm-hmm. Collectives that I think are artist collectives have been an important part of art in the 20th century, to be sure. But there's something happening, I think, at this moment that I do see in cities like Detroit, like in Philadelphia, somewhat in Los Angeles, and certainly in Baltimore, where artists are pooling their resources. They are creating collectives where they're able to address shared concerns. Maybe they might even live in a loft together. Mm-hmm. It's a gallery space on the weekends. It's a performance space. It's music. It's art. It's poetry. It's this sort of a creative community that is largely unknown. I wouldn't say unknown, perhaps more underground, right?
It's beneath the establishment
yes,
radar.
Yes, that's what I'm getting at.
That's right.
Because it shouldn't be unknown. It should really be seen more and have a larger voice, because I think what happens when artists stay in a city, when they can find that support, when they can find a gallery or two that might be able to share their work, where they can find community support, artist grants, housing that is affordable, and like-minded people that can sort of rally around an idea and a community. This is what can make our cities so vibrant, so exciting, make neighborhoods interesting again, right? Mm-hmm. So I do see a lot of that happening in Baltimore, and that's incredibly exciting. It's incredibly exciting to see. It is incredibly exciting in terms of the kind of program that we have, because we will continue to bring artists from all over the world to share that with the community here. But the dialogue that now is beginning with the artists that we're bringing in from elsewhere and the local artists, that's become really exciting. We've started to incorporate and invite local artists into the mix of what we do. And that's where some really exciting collaborations have happened and where the dialogue really spreads out locally in the community, into the city. So
there's a huge artistic community in this town.
Absolutely.
Between Peabody and Micah and everything else.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's here.
And artists themselves are, I mentioned Fritz kind of having a hybrid artistic practice. That is the same for many people who are here. Artist, musician, gallery owner. I mean, there are a number of wonderful artist-run galleries here that where a single person will have all those hats. And that becomes really exciting.
So if you, as someone who's been here for now 4 years, almost 4 years, three and a half.
Four and a half.
Four and a half. Mm-hmm. The math is up my strong suit, so 4.5 years. What do you have to say to Baltimore about maybe, I don't mean to make this sound negative, shortcomings is what I was going to say, places where we could think about building something more powerful and more rich based on what we have that we may not be seeing?
Well, I think my vision for mm-hmm. this community that I'm describing is that it's not just known locally. I think the vision for success should be beyond Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
The vision for recognition of what's happening here, I think artists should aspire to be more than just have Baltimore know that they exist and that what's here is really exciting. It's the nation. How about that?
That sounds good.
How about invite the art world?
Mm-hmm.
Seen everything in New York. Okay, fine. But what happens here when I have brought New York curators, forget it, LA curator. When I brought curators or writers to Baltimore and shown them what's here, they're excited about it. It's fresh to them. It feels really new and exciting. And for me, I'd like to see that, the aspiration. That would be success when the rest of the nation starts paying attention to the art world here. How about that?
I like that. That works fine. I like that. One other thing, as we wind away to the contemporary itself and what's coming up and what's going on over the next year, I'm really fascinated by some of the exhibits and things you have planned. One of the things in this town, as many other places, where it can be a very divided city in terms of class and race and all the confusion between those ideas. So talk about how you see the role of art in changing that and in reaching out to that, and also your own work at the contemporary, because we can see one of the things that, again, quick digression, one of the things that I loved what Gary did at Recon at the Walters, when he said, "We're in a tough financial place, but I'm opening the Walters for free." And when he did that, all of a sudden, working-class African-American families and working-class families in general who ordinarily couldn't afford to, wouldn't go to the museum, flood the museum.
Right.
It changes the nature of perceptions and life and interactions. And that's really very critically important, I think.
Right.
So talk to me about your vision of that and how you think the work you do and the work of the contemporary fits into this world of trying to create these artistic human bridges.
Sure. Well, I think where what our role has been and should continue to be is to show work, work with artists that reflects the community. In other words, that the kinds of artists that we choose to work with, they're creating images that resonate with the community. Last summer, we worked with the Chicago-based photographer Dawood Bey.
Oh, yes, I remember that one. Yeah.
And Dawood is known for his incredibly powerful portraits of teens.
Right.
Mostly teens from inner-city schools, large-scale, amazing images, right? And who puts teenagers on the wall in the museum? This
right.
was a really powerful experience for young people to come and see themselves reflected in the art that's there. So that is really part of the answer to your question, is to work with artists that are really engaged with the very community that we are trying to invite in, reach out to, and connect with. The next exhibition is a large-scale collaboration between the Contemporary Museum and the Maryland Institute College of Arts Exhibition Development Seminar course. It's going to be in 7 venues throughout the city. And the main venue will be the Contemporary Museum. And this is a married couple, Bradley McCallum and Jacqueline Terry. They're an interracial couple.
Oh, yeah, I know who they are.
She is black. He is white.
Right.
Their work ranges from self-portrait videos where they enact various both historic and contemporary relations between black and white. They have done paintings that are looking back at archival images of the civil rights movement. They have done work that deals with gun violence, teen pregnancy, homelessness. I mean, it's tough stuff.
Right.
But it results in really beautiful work that I think will connect with a number of segments of our community, because we're also putting this work out in the city. Shot Tower, Carroll House, Maryland Art Place, Walters Art Museum, Reginald Lewis Museum. All of these museums are and historic sites are part of this project, and each will be taking a work or series of works that somehow relates to their own history, to the building they have. And so, long answer to your question, but I think it's both in the artists that we choose, the content of their work, and how it manifests. And then the final piece of that is inviting the audience to come. We have always been free, but we are much smaller. And it is harder to spread the word about what we are doing. So part of what we think will be the power of this upcoming exhibition is that the venues are spread out throughout the city. And hopefully people will connect with one and be curious about the
rest.
And
when does this happen?
It opens on May 8th.
May 8th.
It's coming really soon.
Very soon.
Yes.
Oh, that's really interesting. So now the ones you have going in the first part of this year, like the what is still there?
Right now at the Contemporary?
Yeah, the Finishing School.
Right. Yes. Right now at the Contemporary, we have part one of a year and a half long exhibition series that I've called Project 20. Again, celebrating the Contemporary's 20th anniversary. I wanted to do something that both looked back at the museum's history, but yet still moved forward. And that idea was to invite 20 people from the museum's past directors, past curators, and artists who spent substantial time in Baltimore and created some of the most memorable projects while they were here. And I invited those 20 people to each choose one artist to be in a show. And I asked them to think about their own practice. I asked them to think about the future of contemporary art, who they think is most interesting to them at this moment. And everyone chose an artist. And I had this amazing, raucous list of artists working in all media. And I've turned that now into a series of exhibitions. So we're just starting to roll that out. The first part is what's up at the museum right now. Found that a number of artists on the list were creating work that invited the audience to contribute the content of the work. So that's why we've called the show Participation Nation. It includes three pieces that rely on the audience to complete them. So we have a radio station.
I know, I love that part.
We have Neighborhood Public Radio.
From Albuquerque, right?
Well,
isn't that where it began?
I love these guys. There are three guys. One is in Albuquerque. One is in San Diego, and the other is in Chicago. Okay. I really think of them as sort of a Skype collective. That's really where their meetings happen. Uh-huh. And then they're invited to venues. They set up a radio station that then is turned over to the neighborhood, to the community, to the city where it is. And now it's open. We have bands coming in on Sundays, and they are broadcasting on the web. So one of the members of Neighborhood Public Radio is in Albuquerque, and every Wednesday morning his class broadcasts. So we have to turn the volume down if we don't remember that it's Wednesday morning. So that is one piece. Li Ming Wei has created a work that is called the Pantheon Project. He created these beautiful wood boxes with each one with a light in them. They look a little bit like dioramas. We hung them on the wall and invited the community to write proposals for shrines, to build a shrine in these boxes to a person, to an idea, really to anything. And people did. We got letters, sent them to the artist, and he in turn then made selections, and that's what's there. Finishing School is the final one, another collective from Los Angeles, and they have created a work that invites people to get lost in their own neighborhood, record what they see, and send that back to the museum in the form of tweets, photographs, and objects that they might bring. The project is called Go, the Go Project. So it's quite lively, and the show has been changing and growing over the course of the exhibition.
And so what's coming up, this what's leaving, what's coming up, when you hear this interview, the project coming up, what we just talked about a minute ago, is Bearing Witness.
Bearing Witness, that is part two of Project 20. Bearing Witness, work by Bradley McCallum and Jacqueline Terry. Yep.
We'll do more about that soon, in the next week or two. Make sure you all know where that's happening. It's been great to finally meet you and have you in the studio, and let's not be strangers and keep this thing going.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you here.
Thank you.
So much. We've been with Irene Hoffman, Executive Director of the Contemporary. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-5555. 462-7555.